This is Francis. For this Footnotes episode, we're going to hear a conversation about the practice of Buddhist chaplaincy in Canada. All three of our guests today have gone through Emmanuel College's Buddhist chaplaincy program. Emmanuel College is located in Toronto. Carl and Winnie are just completing their Master of Pastoral Studies degree, focusing on Buddhist spiritual care. And Joanne Yuasa completed that program recently. Joanne is a Jodo Shinshu Buddhist minister, and she's in training to be a military chaplain also. In this conversation, Joanne talks about how she came to Buddhism as an adult and about her experiences with social anxiety disorder. Carl, Winnie, and Joanne share their experiences of engaging with Buddhist practice in moments of suffering and distress. They also talk about working in hospital clinics as Buddhist care providers and about the role of practices like deep listening and chanting mantras. Namanda, Vichnamanda,
Vichnamanda, Vichnamanda, Vichnamanda, Vichnamanda. Hi, Joanne and Winnie. This is Carl. I am a student at Emmanuel College at the University of Toronto in the Master of Pastoral Studies Buddhist stream. I'm also currently finishing my second CPD unit placement at CAMH, at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. Also, I have been part of Buddhist sanghas for maybe about a dozen years or so. I've been part of the Plum Village tradition, Thich Nhat Hanh. I've also sat in the tradition of Essen Goenka, the Vipassana tradition, and more recently here in Toronto, sangha called Satipanya, that's in the Theravadan tradition. I use he, him, or they, them is fine with me also. I'm a white person who's originally from the U.S. and has been living as an immigrant in Canada for the past 10 years or so.
Hi, Carl. Hi, Joanne. Welcome, Joanne. I'm Winnie, pronounced she, her. I'm an MPS student at Emmanuel College and a spiritual care intern at Baycrest. I'm from Taiwan, and I came to Canada in 2010. I grew up practicing and surrounded by Buddhism and Confucianism.
Hi, Carl and Winnie. Thank you for inviting me to this conversation. My name is Joanne. My pronouns are she, hers. I just graduated the MPS program at Emmanuel College last year. I was in the Buddhist stream. I came to Buddhism as an adult. I was born in Japan. I'm an immigrant and raised in Vancouver. I'm an Asian woman of color. I am currently a minister for the Jodo Shinshu Buddhist Temples of Canada, and I currently serve at the Toronto Buddhist Church. I'm also at the Toronto Buddhist Church. I'm also the ministerial intern there, which is part of my training to be a military chaplain for the Canadian Armed Forces in the Royal Canadian Chaplain Service. I'm a lieutenant in the Royal Canadian Air Force.
We're here to talk about what it is to offer Buddhist care, in particular in areas of chaplaincy and spiritual care, psychotherapy. Perhaps a good jumping off point for us would be to talk about how you understand suffering and the process of healing.
You know, as Buddhists, we all know that this was the first teaching of the Buddha, and it informs my appreciation of the Buddhist teachings. When I heard the Four Noble Truths for the first time, and that the first noble truth is life is dukkha. Life is often translated as suffering. Nowadays, I think we tend to use the word like discomfort or disease because suffering seems like such a big, big word. It seems like such a heavy, dark thing sometimes. So when I heard that, the first thing that the Buddha taught to an audience was that life is suffering, I thought, yeah, absolutely. That is 100% my experience. I get where you're coming from. Tell me more. I want to know more about this. And so really it started from there. Not to say that I had a lot of suffering in my life. I don't think we should compare suffering, but you know, we all have difficulties in our life, right? And that's what the Buddha said. I really resonated with that. I did not grow up in a religious home. Anything that was that looked kind of religious was based on my Japanese culture. I didn't know why we were doing these things, but I did them, and I knew that they were. It was part of my culture. I hit a wall when I was just about in high school. Looking back in hindsight, that is when the darkest of my suffering began. So what happened was, as I was finishing high school, I was expected to go to university. I was a really good student and I was very capable. And so it was very, you know, it was kind of like, oh, of course she's going to go to university. But I couldn't make it happen. So I skipped town, and I grew up in Vancouver. I skipped town and I went to Japan for almost a year. I thought, oh, I'm going to touch base with my roots and I'm going to get in touch with my family. And I mean, I was close to my family. All of my extended family are there. I was with them for about a year. I came back. I felt like I was stuck. I thought, you know, I was really confused about why can't I get a job? Like I couldn't even start the process of trying to get a job or applying to university. I was just stuck. Part of this path was I went to the doctor, and my GP, my family doctor, was like, your body is showing a lot of signs of stress. And she would ask me about my life. And she said, well, you're not living, you're surviving. While I was going through all this, and I was feeling really stuck, I also started to cut ties with my friends. Obviously, I couldn't get a job. I couldn't apply for a job. I wasn't going to school. I was just at home all the time. And this was getting really quite bad. Like I was not functioning. Ultimately, my doctor sent me to a therapist. Together, I was diagnosed with social anxiety disorder and depression, which explained why I was having such a hard time interacting with other people. It was so bad at a certain point, I wasn't talking to my family, like my immediate family, mom, dad, brother. I didn't talk to them for like 3 years at one point. And I was living with my mom. I was living with my mom. The only person I had communication with was with my boyfriend at the time, who was also living with us. And he was the only person I communicated with. And so, you know, you can see that that's bad. And that was suffering. I didn't know it because I was really actually quite comfortable in this lifestyle that I had kind of formulated for myself. But I also understood that I was not functioning in this world. And so with the help of my therapist, I don't know what modality she used. I don't know. I'm pretty sure she's not a chaplain or a spiritual care practitioner, but in her very capable way, she, within our sessions, she picked up on my interest in religion. And so after about 3 years of regular sessions, she said to me one day, okay, you got to go out into the world now. You got these tools that will help you deal with cope with your social anxiety disorder. You got to go out into the world. And so she suggested, with your interest in religion and with your familiarity culturally with Buddhism, why don't you try going to the temple? Which I lived like 5 blocks away from this temple, the Vancouver Buddhist Temple. And she said, oh, you'll get along. I think you'll be fine there. It'll because, you know, they're Japanese Canadian. So you will connect with them culturally. You're interested in Buddhism and, you know, they're Buddhist. And Buddhists are nice, she says to me. They're really nice. So it's a safe place to go. And I went. The lady who answered the phone said, yeah, come. It's great. You know, we sit around after the service and we talk about what the sensei talked about. And, you know, I really go for most of it is for the social aspect. That's my favorite part. And I was like, oh my gosh, well, that's not a useful thing to say with somebody with social anxiety disorder. But okay, my therapist said I need to go. So I went. And I was at first very much struck by the familiarity of it, like the scent of the incense and obviously the language that was used there. People spoke to me in Japanese. The minister there was Japanese, Aoki Sensei. And there was a kind of natural familiarity there for me. And, you know, my therapist was right. They were very nice people and they just kept inviting me back and I kept going back. And ultimately, it became a very central part of my life. And I tell you all this now because I see how, for me, Buddhism and being on the path, being immersed in the teachings, in the Dharma, being in a Sangha, being with Amida Buddha, which is the central Buddha in my tradition of Shin Buddhism, that is absolutely part of my healing. Buddhism helped me identify that I was suffering. It allowed me to kind of process my suffering. And then becoming aware of that on the Buddhist path absolutely led to my healing. By healing, I don't mean I'm completely cured. Social anxiety disorder is not something that is cured or eradicated, but I've learned how to live with it. It's not a coping mechanism. The healing for me is accepting it as part of my life, making it part of my identity, and feeling whole in that identity. To me, that's what healing is. It's not necessarily an eradication of the problem, for lack of a better word. And it's not an eradication of symptoms. Healing is about being whole.
In my personal experience and when I encounter with clients, the healing starts with when they accept that, okay, this may be the rest of life I need to live with depression or anxiety or bipolar. Because I see a lot of clients, they cannot accept this and they just want, they are constantly looking for this magic pill that they can take to just feel back normal again when they describe normal as like before they started to have their first episode. And I was like that before. I also took like different medication and none of those helped. So then I was so mad because of the side effects. So I basically just stopped all the medication at once, which wasn't recommended. A manager told me, he basically say, and it may be with you for the rest of your life, but you'll need to face it. Because of that, it takes away my shame of having depression, guilt of, oh, I must do something wrong. I'm so weak. That's why I have depression. None of that. Like it, once I heard that, how she described it, I don't feel as shame and guilt. And I started to know, okay, these things will be with me for the rest of my life. And I need to learn to live with it instead of avoiding it or escape from it or just trying so hard to search the reason why I'm having it or searching the cure of just not having it anymore. Things started to change when I started to accept and learn to live with it. Of course, it's really difficult. I switch a lot of therapists, but I become functionable.
Yeah, I would agree with both of you. Like aspects of what you both shared, I definitely resonate from my own personal experience. And I think that the best thing I've ever done for myself and my mental health was an extended meditation retreat where I had the experience of like experiencing the Buddhist concept of anicca or impermanence in like an embodied way and noticing, like learning how to accept what was arising in my body and my mind emotionally and to learn to be with that without habitually reacting to it. My own struggles with periods of depression or anxiety, they still happen. But I think that the tools or the skills and the ideas that I've come to in part through Buddhist practice and study have definitely put me on the path of healing. I think healing is a practice. It's not like there's not a finish line or a mountaintop.
I started in Buddhism because of, thanks to my mental illness, sometimes I like to say, because as a therapeutic, as a path to wellness, right? But now that I it's become so much more than that, though, in the sense that it does obviously still help me live with social anxiety disorder, but my goal now is beyond that, being able to live with mental health or in mental health. It is legitimately about, I want to be a Buddha. I want to attain enlightenment. That is the only way you will have complete peace. As a Buddhist, that is my ultimate goal. But I see that in that path, it helps me in my human life, in my human form, in this lifetime. It has the benefits of bringing me wholeness and healing.
I heard you say you want to be Buddha in enlightenment. And I wonder if, like, elaborate a little bit more on that for people who may not understand what does that mean?
Sure. Well, we believe in the cycle of life and death. So after this lifetime, when I die, it could be thought that I will be reincarnated as something else based on what happened in this life. So ultimately, what a Buddhist wants is to escape these cycles of life and death, because we believe that in a human form, I mean, I might not come back as a human, or, you know, I'm quite fortunate. I had good karma that I came back as a human. I could have come back as a dog, which is also not bad, but a dog doesn't have the ability to aspire for Buddhahood.
I'm wondering, now that there's a kind of clear explanation of where you're coming from and your background and your relationship to the Buddhist tradition, that if you could share with us about how does that figure in the work that you do as a chaplain, as a caregiver, with clients, whether it's in the hospital system or in the armed forces, mm-hmm. or in other contexts where they may or may not identify as Buddhists?
When the idea of going to the Vancouver Buddhist Temple came up, that's where I was really lucky, in that this temple, this particular organization of temples, seemed really familiar to me. So I was really very, very lucky in that way. There are a lot of people who come to Jodo Shinshu temples in Canada. There are 10 of them across the country. They have no background in Japanese or Japanese Canadian-ness or what have you. But for me, I was very, very fortunate. I actually do call it a privilege of mine that I understood the language, I understood the culture. So when I went, and when I started to go, the things that I would hear just very easily sank into me. The only thing that was kind of made it difficult was my struggle to try to understand these things. But through listening, I realized, well, I can just let go. And I was very lucky that I was able to just kind of sink into the rhythms, the language, the forms, the sights, the smells of the temple. And because of my ease in that, I very easily became part of a community. And being part of the community as well, and having friends for the first time in years, having somebody gave me a job because of what they saw me do as a volunteer in the temple kitchen. They're like, oh, she's pretty good with a knife. We should hire her for our store. So I got a job for the first time in like 10 years. I really believe, I genuinely believe that this temple, this community, the teachings gave me a life. It gave me a life and it gave me a purpose, which I did not have, you know, for the 7 or 8 years that I was in the darkness of my social anxiety disorder. So when I realized, oh my gosh, I have been given so much, there's no way I could repay them in any, you know, equal measure. The only thing I can do is give them myself, my life almost. And that's what inspired me to get ordination. Like, it was just a way for me to give back. With my experience with mental illness and with my experiential understanding that religion and spirituality can be a momentous factor in somebody's healing and feeling of wholeness, I became aware of the MPS program, the Master of Pastoral Studies program in psycho-spiritual care at Emmanuel College. And somebody said, yeah, have you looked at that? I mean, it's about, you know, applying Buddhism into this field of healthcare, really. And I thought that is perfect because I couldn't quite see myself as a temple minister. I thought I would be of more use outside of the box of the temple. So if there are other people in the world who are distressed, whether it be mental illness or anything for that matter, I want to make sure that Buddhism is accessible for these folks the way it was for me. Like the second month I was in the program, I was approached by a professor, also a classmate, about Buddhist military chaplaincy. And I said, yes, of course, no doubt, let's do this. It was crystal clear to me why I wanted to do it personally, but also as a minister, as somebody who is ordained in the Shin Buddhist teachings, I thought, no question, I want to do this. And then it's kind of started from there.
How do you do Buddhist chaplaincy in the armed forces or in the hospital or like for you? Like, what does that actually look like if you're meeting with a client?
I am in CPE at Baycrest with Winnie, and I've done 3 units of CPE, clinical pastoral education, as a chaplain. We call ourselves multi-faith chaplains, but of course, our own religious identity 100% informs how we engage with clients and patients and how we express ourselves and all these kinds of things. Jodo Shinshu, from my, you know, I guess, from my estimation, is really perfect for multi-faith chaplaincy. Jodo Shinshu is a tradition of Buddhism that started way back in 13th century Japan. I'm going to start calling it Shin Buddhism because that's usually what it's called in North America and in English. So Shin Buddhism is a very lay-oriented tradition in the sense that we don't have monastics. We don't have monks and nuns. We have ministers who in North America are called reverends or sensei. These folks are considered teachers, people on the path, people who have committed themselves to the path of learning and being alongside other Shin Buddhists. What makes Shin Buddhism really a great foundation for multi-faith chaplaincy is that because we are a lay-oriented tradition, it makes me very flexible to be with someone who does not experience religion or spirituality in the same way that I do. And so Jodo Shinshu has a very, very broad understanding of what it looks like to be a Buddhist, to be a Shin Buddhist. Jodo Shinshu does not have meditation as a central practice in the way we think of meditation in the North American English-speaking sense. We don't have that because some people can't meditate, which means they would be limited from attaining enlightenment. Or one of the things that we put a lot of emphasis on is something called deep listening. Deep listening is an actual phrase in Shin Buddhism and is one of the things that we are encouraged to practice, encouraged to engage in our daily lives. This is a way for Shin Buddhists to become aware of the oneness of life, become aware of Amida Buddha's wisdom and compassion without strict or highly formulated practice. So deep listening for me is where Shin Buddhism and chaplaincy, multi-faith chaplaincy, intersect. It means being present, being aware, being observant, looking for clues as to what the other person is trying to convey to you in through their speech and how their face is looking. Their body language is very important.
That's great. I think that's like I hear, hearing that kind of addresses mm-hmm. some of the questions that I had, Winnie and I had, around how to deal with differences in social location and religious and spiritual identity and even diversity within the Buddhist community. What you just said around deep listening and how you understand yourself. I was just curious if you relate that to the concept of skillful means. Is that something that resonates in your tradition or in your chaplaincy practice?
Yeah, within Shin Buddhism, within my identity as a chaplain, skillful means is about understanding what works for you or what will be useful in this particular situation. So I can't broadly say this will work for you, this will not work for you. It's really up to the person to know this will work for me or not. And I am there to support them, be with them, hold that space for them. And I think that goes across the board with any kind of intervention or practice in chaplaincy and also Shin Buddhism. It's not up to me. I cannot judge what is right and wrong for somebody else.
Well, I wonder if you have something you want to share about how chanting helped you, because I remember when I attended to your service, chanting is a huge part in the service. And I remember feeling calm when I was there hearing the chanting. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you have something you want to add to this part.
In Shin Buddhism, in English, we don't use the word mantra. We don't use the word mantra, but we do have a phrase that is voiced often in our tradition. And it is Namo Amida Butsu. Namo Amida Butsu. We say that all the time. It is not a tool that helps us in meditation. It is not doctrinally speaking, it's not a practice, but we do it as a expression of our gratitude and as our, you could even say faith, in Amida Buddha. Namo Amida Butsu means I take refuge in Amida Buddha. It is also comes up in chanting. Chanting we do all the time. And chanting is the way we show our reverence and respect for the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha, which are about Amida Buddha. So it is a way for us to show respect, not necessarily as a thing that makes you feel anything. It's not supposed to make you feel anything, although we understand that by doing it, it has kind of beneficial effects. People do feel grounded. They feel comfort. They feel connected with the rest of the Sangha when they hear other voices. So again, it's not something we do to create an effect, but it does have these effects. One of the first Dharma talk that I ever attended was by this really great sensei. The talk was called Buddhism for Dummies. And I thought, oh, this is perfect for me. So I went, and it was really like within the first month or two that I'd gone to temple. And he said, you know what, I'm going to say stuff that you might not understand. What I want you to remember and what I want you to take away from this talk are the two eyes of Buddhism. And the two eyes of Buddhism, the letter I, are impermanence and interconnectedness or interdependence. So both the words start with the letter I, and both of the words are very foundational to the understanding of Buddhism and the Buddhist worldview, in that, I mean, it's not even a worldview, right? It's like the truth is that all things are connected, interconnectedness and interdependence. Everything is dependent on each other. And impermanence, all things change all the time. So he said, if you can remember these two eyes of Buddhism, and if you can see the world through these two eyes, and then here, obviously, he switches to like our eyeballs. If you can see the world through these two eyes, you will understand what it is that Buddhists do. This is what we do. And I thought, oh, I'm going to remember that forever. And I'm still talking about it, almost 20 years on.
Thank Joanne being interviewed and talking with us about everything here today. It was really wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time, wisdom,
yeah,
and openness. Mm-hmm.